understand, as Trump bows down to dictators, he makes America weak. And that is disqualifying for someone who wants to be Commander-in-Chief of the United States of America. That is disqualifying.
Well, we'll see if it's disqualifying. We'll see.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's one reason.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep. From Pacifica Radio, Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast. That's heard on KPFK, 90.7 FM in L.A. Elsewhere in California, in Red Bluff and Redding, on KFOI and Round Mountains, KKRN. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast, on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, and Eugene's KEPW. Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day for you on the internets, on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites. Blanketing Planet Earth, I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today for what I'd love to say will be another thrilling edition of the Bradcast.
Your mileage may vary.
But who knows? Who knows? As we go to air today, it is actually just before President Biden's big post-NATO summit, his big solo press conference at the White House. I think it's at the White House. Is it at the White House?
So,
a lot of people will be watching that, I expect. We will have to offer any insights or coverage of it, however, as helpful or as not helpful on our next Bradcast. Though the good news is that means we may be able to cover a few other issues of note for a happy change today.
There are some other things going on.
We'll see how it goes, though. I got a few thoughts I want to get off my chest here. Hello, Desi Doyen. Did I say that was you? Hi, Desi Doyen.
Now you have.
All right. Of course, many are watching that press conference as part of what I think can best be described as a media and political death watch at this point for the Joe Biden 2024 candidacy. Not for Joe Biden. He's okay. But for his candidacy at this point, following his... rough, to say the least, performance in this year's first presidential debate last month. So will he meet or beat or disappoint expectations? I don't know. By the time you hear this, you probably know better than I do. Especially since those expectations themselves continue to be a bit of a moving target this week after Congress reconvened following the 4th of July holiday with a bit more support for Biden than I think was expected by many, as he declared in a 2-page letter to lawmakers that he was absolutely staying in the race and that he was in it to win it and all of that, only to be followed up as the week sort of wore on by a drip, drip, drip by various members of Congress and high-profile supporters of the president declaring that, that he needs to get out of the race in order to hold off the menacing autocratic threat of a second Donald Trump presidency and a potential Republican majority takeover of both the House and Senate in November. That, despite the fact that there has been really little change in presidential polling since the disastrous debate. A new Washington Post ABC News survey out on Thursday found that a whopping 67% of Americans believe President Biden should end his reelection campaign. That includes 56% of Democrats, 73% of Republicans, and I guess most disturbingly here, 73% of independents. But the race between Joe Biden and Donald Trump for the popular vote nationally is nonetheless tied, according to this poll. By the way, that same poll shows that Vice President Kamala Harris is actually up over Donald Trump in a head-to-head national race by 2 points. But the notion that there's this huge number of Americans who believe that Biden should end the reelection campaign and yet find him tied with Donald Trump, frankly, that may give you a sense of how wildly unpopular Donald Trump is across the nation. A huge majority of Americans think Joe Biden should not even be running at this point. And yet he is still tied with the presumptive Republican nominee. I take some hope in that, I think. On the other hand, that nominee is a twice impeached 34 count convicted felon, fraud, and sexual assaulter. So I don't know, maybe it might not be saying quite as much as it seems. Democrats didn't need Joe Biden to stay tied or competitive with Trump after the debate, apparently. Apparently, they needed to see some upward movement in his support numbers. They didn't need a tie. That was happening before the debate. They need those numbers to go up because those support numbers are historically low for an incumbent president seeking a second term. And to be honest, with the ever-increasing calls for Joe Biden to step aside at this point, I got to say, I'm not sure that how he can ultimately hang on and how that can ultimately be avoided, that he's not pushed aside at this point. But we will see. By way of a side note here, Heather Digby Parton, you may recall on this show yesterday, if you heard it, she made a great point. She noted that if Joe Biden is going to step aside, she would very much like him to wait until the night that Donald Trump is supposed to officially receive the Republican Party nomination at the convention beginning next week. I think she said just to stab him in the back as hard as possible.
On is that the way how she out, put yes. it? Yeah. Yes, she did.
In a similar vein, our friend John Fugelsang, the brilliant comedian and host of his own show on Sirius XM, tweeted the other day, quote, "Like the rest of you, I'm watching the Fellini film Our Country Has Become. I'm not a Democrat, but the GOP generally makes sure I vote that way," he says. Adding, "I humbly ask the step aside Biden versus the stay in there Biden folks to realize something. No decision would or should ever be announced before Man Baby picks his awful running mate at the RNC in Milwaukee next week." He says they're trying so hard to make Democrats fight each other, but guys, whatever processes may or may not be in place wouldn't and shouldn't be acknowledged before then. Well, we'll see. He adds, "Take a deep breath and remember that it is Trumpism versus non-Trumpism."
And it would be smart to apply a little strategy to that.
Yeah, well, we are talking about Democrats, so you know, good luck there. Anyway, where was I? Oh yeah, I don't see how he's going to be able to hang on. We'll see. It's been said that the best way to avoid resignation amid scandal, and to be clear, there's no scandal here. Joe Biden has done nothing wrong other than get old. But the best way to avoid resignation is simply to not resign and basically wait for things to blow over. That, however, does not seem quite as possible here, given both the national attention and, yes, feeding frenzy of a presidential race and a national media who knows how to cover this sort of thing, poorly or otherwise, while having no clue, apparently, as how to appropriately cover a convicted felon and adjudicated rapist who is running for the presidency. So it seems to me, something here is bound to give. Perhaps sooner rather than later, but we will see. But I should note, for all of the doom and gloomsayers out there, a careful review of polling numbers, such as the one that we cited, for example, yesterday, they seem to reveal over and over again that there remains a big upside for Democrats still in these polling numbers, and that there are a whole bunch of folks out there who want to vote against Donald Trump, but seem to still be sending messages to pollsters that they want someone else as an option for that. For example, that poll that I mentioned yesterday from a well-respected Democratic polling firm finds Trump ahead of Biden by 1 point nationally, 43-42. And Kamala Harris, in a hypothetical head-to-head matchup, ahead of Trump by 1 point, 42-41. So if you add up those numbers, 42-41, well, that's 83 or 85 in the case of Trump versus Biden. So that's still, you know, about 15% or so of Americans who will not yet register a choice for either the Republican or Democratic candidate, suggesting that there are still a lot of voters out there withholding their opinions in the presidential contest. Keep that in mind when you see these polling numbers everywhere in the media. It can absolutely be seen, it seems to me, those people who are, you know, who won't give an answer, basically, can absolutely be seen as messaging, message sending, if you will, by those respondents that they're not yet happy with either of the presumptive nominees. And it's difficult to imagine that there's something particularly new that will ever be learned about Donald Trump at this point that might sway those voters in his favor. But either a new candidate on the Democratic side or the realization that, yes, Joe Biden actually, truly, honestly, really will be the Democratic candidate, which, you know, that news for some folks would only come after he is officially nominated by the DNC in August, if in fact that actually happens, well, that might bring many Democratic voters, or at least the anti-Trump voters, finally, home to Joe Biden. Or home to whoever turns out to be the official Democratic nominee. That's the theory anyway. We'll see if it comes to pass. But I do mention it today, if only to note, I have been warning for some time that it was going to be a very bumpy ride between here and November 5th.
True.
And, by the way, beyond November 5th. Don't forget that part. Don't forget the beyond part. And that's true no matter what we learn on election night. As I've said many times, I don't know what I fear the most at this point. Donald Trump wins or Donald Trump loses on November 5th. So, you know, please stay in good health, drink a lot of water, eat healthy foods, because we may be at this for a while, even beyond Election Day, as much as we all can't wait for Election Day to get here, right? But I also note all of this to try and remind you that, you know, no, all hope is absolutely not lost for this constitutional Republican democracy, and that we can, in fact, absolutely still save it from the Donald Trump MAGA Republicans who are trying to overturn democracy and this nation as we know it in favor of a fascio-Christian nationalist autocracy. That's what they now hope for. That's what they're now planning for. That's what they now think they've got in the bag. I don't know that they do. And there's a lot of evidence to show that they don't. So all of that by way of saying, let's stay positive, people. That was mostly a pep talk for me, perhaps. I don't know. But I know it ain't easy. I know that politics ain't beanbag, as they say, and the fight for democracy over fascist tyranny has never been easy. Just ask the folks fighting with their lives right now in Ukraine. It has never been easy, even as we've come to take much of it for granted over too many decades, particularly since World War II. Much of that, frankly, thanks to the NATO alliance. So if you need any reminder about the dangers and about the necessity of that fight, democracy over fascist tyranny, well, Donald Trump is offering a little bit of help, a little reminder about that today. As Hungary's authoritarian strongman, Prime Minister Viktor Orban, is meeting with Donald Trump down in Florida on Thursday. The meeting comes shortly after Orban's surprise meeting in recent days with both Russian strongman Vladimir Putin and Chinese leader Xi Jinping in a bit of a shuttle diplomacy between strongmen and wannabe strongmen focused on supporting Russia's attempted takeover of democratic Ukraine, even as NATO leaders were in D.C. this week to discuss that very topic. The Hungarian strongman happened to take over the European Union's rotating presidency at the start of July. Yes, Viktor Orban is now the head of the European Union, well, the president in any event of the European Union. He was not elected. It's a rotating position, and aren't we lucky it just happens to be the fascist from Hungary's turn for the role? But he did so when he took over that presidency with a promise to, quote, make Europe great again. That was his promise. Make Europe great again. Of course, echoing the Make America Great Again slogan of Donald Trump, who Orban has endorsed for the U.S. presidency. Trump, of course, has a history of praising authoritarian leaders and often cites Orban's support on the campaign trail. The two men met in March at Mar-a-Lago, where Donald Trump threw a party for him, lauded him as a, quote, boss because he doesn't tolerate political dissent in Hungary. That is to be lauded, apparently. Both, of course, are aligned in their anti-immigrant, pro-Christian nationalist views, and incredibly, their skepticism of the post-World War II order and the NATO alignment. Trump's meeting with Orban follows on the heels of Orban's more than two-hour meeting in Moscow on July 5 with Vladimir Putin, a rare trip to Russia at this point by a European Union leader. That caused alarm in world capitals, and that was followed by another unexpected visit this past Monday to Beijing by Orban just before the NATO summit in D.C. hosted by President Biden for some previously unannounced talks, apparently, with China's strongman leader, supposedly, according to China's official summary of that meeting, to exchange their ideas for ending the war in Ukraine.
Oh, the timing is just so interesting. I'm sure it's not coincidental at all.
You sound kind of sarcastic today, Desi Doyen.
I am quite cynical, I must say. I mean, what are the odds that, say, I don't know, Orban maybe brought some instructions from Vladimir Putin to give to Trump when he's at Mar-a-Lago, ensuring that nobody has a chance to know what was said or what was exchanged? I don't know. Just, you know, that's how my mind thinks.
Your conspiratorial mind.
My cynical mind, yes.
Okay, well, we'll see. Anyway, that's going on. That's going on today. At the same time, here's some other news of note that is probably, you know, getting lost amid the feeding frenzy at the White House right now. Inflation eased even more than expected in June. That, according to new numbers released on Thursday from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, handing the Federal Reserve yet another dose of encouraging data as they inch closer to finally cutting post-pandemic interest rates. Interest rates that affect everything from mortgages to credit card payments and giving long-awaited relief to households and businesses if and when they finally do cut those rates. The Consumer Price Index reportedly rose just 3%. Year over year in June. That is slower than the 3.3 annual rate the month before and much slower than the post-pandemic inflation rates across every other nation in the developed world. So inflation is down now to 3%. Normal, or at least what the Fed has targeted, is about 2%. So we're almost there. It keeps coming down. From May to June, prices, however, actually fell 0.1%. That's the first time the monthly reading has meaningfully declined since May of 2020, early in the pandemic. A lot of people have said, well, the rate of inflation, the rate of growth in inflation is slowing. Well, inflation itself is actually coming down, and now we are actually seeing prices themselves falling. Thanks, Joe Biden. Additionally, a key measure of inflation that strips out the more volatile categories such as food and energy, known as core inflation, that rose just 3.3% over the past 12 months. That is the smallest increase since April of 2021. According to Joe Brussels, chief economist at RSM, summing up the news, he said, quote, "It is better than good." Thursday's report from the BLS adds to hopes that the Fed will cut interest rates in September. That would bring some relief to voters ahead of November's election, according to NBC, which both parties expect could hinge on Americans' view of an otherwise solid economy. The upbeat inflation news was touted by the White House, especially the cooling prices for big budget items like cars and appliances. We'll talk about appliances a little bit later this hour.
Yes, we
will. On Desi's Green News Report. Airfares, groceries. The White House also noted that its own policies for beating back inflation have been key here. As they noted, so-called core inflation, which excludes volatile food and energy prices, that climbed just 0.1% from May to June. That's the slowest monthly growth since January of 2021. That's good news. Gasoline prices fell 3.8%. Energy prices also fell 2%, the same level as the month before. So they continue, energy continues to fall. Used vehicle prices fell by 1.5%. Shelter costs, which have stubbornly propped up inflation reading for many months, those did rise a little bit, 0.2% in June. Overall, food prices rose a bit, but certain grocery categories gave households relief. Fruit and vegetables, for example, along with cereals and bakery products all fell over May. That, at the same time as the unemployment rate stands at historically low levels. All, once again, thanks to Joe Biden. And of course, it's not all thanks to Joe Biden. But
Biden did land the economic plane. And I just want to point out that, you know, gas prices are now about where they were in 2019 before the pandemic. But you're not hearing about that in the media. You're not hearing about much about any of this. All you're hearing is that same drum, not the same drumbeat that we heard before when prices were going up.
And what you're going to hear at the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee is whatever the price is right now, the average price, I don't know what it is for gas. Let's call it $3. Well, when I was in office, I had gas down to $1.19, Donald Trump is going to tell you next week. Of course, it was down to $1.19. It was actually cheaper than that. They were giving oil away because they had too much oil because nobody was going out. Because if you hadn't heard, there was a goddamn pandemic across the globe and nobody was going anywhere. And Donald Trump wasn't doing a damn thing about it. But now, you bet your bottom dollar, he's going to take credit for the low gas prices that were in place when he was in office, when he left office, with gas just over $1 a gallon.
And he's trying to take credit for the job growth and record low unemployment that the Biden administration policies have put into place. He's calling it whatever, the pandemic bounce back or something, which is absolute nonsense.
Speaking of, speaking of absolute nonsense, but speaking of energy prices, we do have, I mentioned, a Green News report coming up for you in a bit today, as the nation is just being battered this week, really, from coast to coast, with the worsening consequences of our climate crisis caused by the man-made burning of fossil fuels, with the destructive remnants of Hurricane Beryl. from affecting, you know, everywhere from Texas up to Michigan and, yes, of course, into Canada, and just oppressive heat and humidity from the West Coast to the East Coast. Yes, including Texas along the way, where officials are struggling to restore power after the hurricane to millions of residents who are now suffering in ungodly heat and humidity down there in Texas without air conditioning. And without power to keep their food fresh in the bargain. So it was, you know, with no small amount of irony, I thought, that The Nation this week also saw the loss of one of its most notorious climate change deniers, whose horrific work for decades on behalf of the fossil fuel industries, basically, while he was pretending to work for you and me as a U.S. senator, has helped to make all of the human suffering and the death going on right now, this week, his work helped to make all of that much worse. I got a few thoughts on him, and far more importantly, his legacy and how we are continuing to work to, yes, overcome it. That's next on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't touch that dial.
What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. At the broadcast, we do our best to bring you accurate news and analysis on the issues that actually matter, and we do it all independently without corporate or political influence. But we can't do it without you, now more than ever. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Lingers in your ear, but you can't forget from sundown to sunset. Nah, nah. It's all in the air, you hear it everywhere. No matter what you do, it's gonna grab a hold on you. California soul. California soul.
Well, welcome back to the broadcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. We'll get to the California part of this story in a second.
But it's a great song.
Unfortunately, though, well, we have to go through, get here via Oklahoma, sorry to say, on Tuesday, although Oklahoma is delightful and lovely.
Love Oklahoma.
Yeah, but on Tuesday, former Oklahoma U.S. Senator James Mountain Inhofe, and yes, that was actually his middle name, A far-right Republican known mostly for his denial that human activity is responsible for the bulk of climate change. Well, Senator Inhofe died at age 89. Inhofe is described by AP News as a powerful fixture in Oklahoma politics for over six decades. He died on Tuesday morning after suffering a stroke during the July 4th holiday, his family said in a statement. Inhofe was elected to a fifth term in the U.S. Senate in 2020 before stepping down in early 2023. While some this week have been attempting to sort of rewrite Inhofe's legacy, I want to make sure, and I'm glad we're not doing this on the day he died. This is a couple of days after. I don't believe in, you know, speaking ill of the dead 5 minutes after they've died. But I do want to make sure that, you know, he should forever be known, at least in my opinion, as one of the most instrumental villains in the fight to save humanity itself. As he frequently, famously, and insidiously criticized the mainstream, lied about the mainstream science that human activity has caused, at this point, irreversible and certainly deadly changes in the Earth's climate through the unfettered burning of fossil fuels, blocking for years efforts in this nation to take action to roll back or even slow the damage being done to our country at the behest of some of his top campaign funders. And of course, the fossil fuel industry is very powerful in Oklahoma, or used to be. Inhofe is perhaps most famous for comments like this one from, I believe, some point back in 2003.
The notion that man-made gas has caused global warming is probably the greatest hoax ever perpetrated on the American people.
The notion that man-made, what does he say? The burning of
fossil fuels
is the greatest hoax ever perpetrated on America. And of course, for years, that was back in 2003, so more than 20 years ago. And yet, you know damn well, you're going to hear Donald Trump saying the same damn thing in Milwaukee next week. Climate change is the greatest hoax ever perpetrated on the United States. That all comes from, well, at least in part, from James Mountain Inhofe. In February of 2015, during a cold snap in D.C., with temperatures in the nation's capital falling below freezing and some snow going on outside, well, Inhofe famously brought a snowball onto the Senate floor as if it was proof of something, as he claimed that cold weather that day had, you know, somehow disproved decades of climate science. That after a year, 2014, which had, at that point, been the warmest ever recorded on the planet. But all of that was disproven because it got cold outside and it was snowing in D.C. that day.
In case we have forgotten, because we keep hearing that 2014 has been the warmest year on record, I asked the chair, you know what this is? It's a snowball. And that's just from outside here. So it's very, very cold out, very unseasonal. So here, Mr. President, catch this. Mm-hmm. We hear the perpetual headline that 2014 has been the warmest year on record. But now the script has flipped.
Now the script has flipped. What was it? How many was it? 1989, the Senate was first warned about climate change.
Actually, it was 1988 when a former NASA chief scientist, James Hansen, informed the Congress that, hey, greenhouse gas emissions are warming the planet. The science is clear. It is really happening, and we need to act on that.
Starting in 1988, and then I can't do math here. About 30 years later, it snows in D.C., and James Inhofe says, well, now the script has flipped. Look, it's snowing outside.
Clearly, it's all a hoax.
So look, I'm not here to dance on anyone's grave. I am really not. But I do want to take note of this guy's legacy and the pain and the suffering for so many people that has come of it, including this week across the United States, where Americans are suffering amid a record heat wave in the wake of a record storm, that would be Hurricane Beryl, both of which scientists say were made far worse and more deadly thanks to the climate change that James Mountain Inhofe devoted so much of his career to lying and misleading Americans about. Americans, like all of us, who must now struggle to live with his legacy, even after he is gone. That heat, that humidity outside, the power that you do not have down in Texas, yes, that is all part of Inhofe's legacy. But we are making strides, nonetheless, despite the evil work of people like Inhofe and his fellow climate change liar, Rush Limbaugh, who has also died while leaving behind a similar legacy. Both of those terrible men, Desi Doyen, were advised for many years by a guy who is still living, I believe, a moron by the name of Mark Morano. One of the nation's leading longtime climate denier stooges, climate liar stooges. He knows better, right?
Yes, he does.
He's
and
not
he's
an
very,
idiot.
Very wealthy now because of it.
He worked at one point for both Rush Limbaugh as his climate science advisor and to the climate-denying and lying James Inhofe as an advisor to him as well on these points. So, Desi, I can't recall the year that it was. And I didn't feel like going back into the archives to find it. But I think it was at least a decade ago, wasn't it? That
yes.
you and Marano were on a radio program debating, I guess, if we can call it a debate, about climate change. I think it was at least 2010 or something like that.
Oh, yeah, possibly 2010. But yes, he was basically throwing out all of the gish gallop of lies about climate change, climate science, climate scientists, renewable energy. And so I was basically there to say, no, that's a lie. No, that's a lie. And that's a lie, too.
You were actually there to mop up the airways with
him. I tried,
my
best.
To be frank, since you brought facts and science and he brought lies and nonsense. And here's the important, what did he try to tell you at that time on that show, Desi Doyen, about solar and wind energy?
What
did he call it?
He said solar and wind energy are boutique energy sources that will never, ever grow enough to serve U.S. Energy needs.
They can never actually be used at scale anywhere. They're nice, they're cute, they're boutique energy sources. But they can never be used, you know, at scale to do, you know, any heavy lifting of any sort. That comment was not unlike what his buddy James Inhofe was still claiming, even as late as 2019, even as the cost, by the way, for solar and wind had already been plummeting for some time, and becoming a critical part of our energy mix across the country. Here's Inhofe in July of 2019 on that point.
Over 80% of the United States energy comes from fossil fuels. 80%. Now, you eliminate fossil fuels, how do you run this machine called America? The answer is you can't. Our nation runs on American coal, oil, and gas, and that isn't going to change anytime soon.
Well, I guess it depends on soon. Your definition thereof, idiot. That from a guy, by the way, from Oklahoma, for crying out loud. Where the wind comes sweeping down the plain. It's in their goddamn state song, for crying out loud. Anyway, while Marano is still, no doubt, enjoying his millions in paydays from the fossil fuel industry. Hey, Mark, you can't take it with you. Just ask the dead Limbaugh and Inhofe. Anyway, we now have this story out today about that boutique energy source known as solar power that could never be used at scale anywhere. America would be dead in the water with such a clean, renewable energy falling for free from the sky. Anyway, we have this story in what may be the best, quote, bad news story, frankly, that I could possibly find this week, suggesting that California, at least, now has more solar energy than we literally know what to do with. This is from NBC News. It's a common sight across the state. Rows of suburban homes topped with solar panels. And I remember we used to drive around when we would see someone with a solar panel. We'd go, look, they got solar over there.
Yeah.
Now, it's everywhere. At least out here in California. I don't know if you see the same thing around the country, but you certainly see it here in California. NBC continues, but as California works toward its ambitious clean energy vision, an almost counterintuitive challenge has emerged. The state is at times generating more solar energy than it can handle. It's to the point where loads of clean energy are actually going to waste, notes NBC News. Well, that sounds like a very good problem to have. And one that would seem to undercut the nonsense from the dead James Inhofe and the dead Rush Limbaugh and the still living Mark Boutique Energy Marano. The phenomenon, which they note other states are likely to run into as they ramp up their own solar production, is that at certain times of the day, solar production can now exceed demand because solar energy relies on the sun. The issue is most pronounced on sunny days during the spring when not as many people are using power and running their air condition, and we're pulling out or gathering more energy than we actually need to use. Quote, we get into certain times of the year, in the springtime particularly, when the demand for electricity isn't that high yet, and we have quite a bit of solar production, where under certain conditions, we actually have more than California can actually use. That, according to Elliot Mainzer, the CEO of California's independent system operator, which manages 80% of the state's electricity flow. Under those conditions, he says, we take advantage of the significant amount of transmission connectivity that we have to other parts of the West, and we export a lot of that energy for other utilities around the Western United States, he said. Yes, solar energy from California now powers other states, perhaps like Inhofe's Oklahoma, I don't know. You're welcome. Because we sometimes have more solar power than we even know what to do with. Under certain certain extreme conditions, Mainzer added, we actually have to curtail it and turn it all off. According to independent system operator data, in recent years, the amount of renewable energy curtailed or wasted has now skyrocketed from both oversupply and so-called congestion, when there's more electricity than the transmission lines in some areas can handle. So far this year, the state has lost out on nearly 2.6 million megawatt hours of renewable energy, and most of it is solar. How much is 2.6 million megawatt hours? Well, it is enough to power every single home in San Francisco for a year.
That's a lot.
That's a lot. And it's thanks to solar. And our inability, frankly, to use all of the energy that we gather due to outdated transmission lines and other infrastructure issues from a pre-climate changed world, I guess, we're now throwing away enough energy to power every home in one of our major cities for an entire year. What was it Murano was telling you about how solar was a boutique energy that could never really work at scale? Really, Mark? Mainzer said adding transmission lines would help increase the flow of electricity throughout the state, and he's advocating for exactly that. Quote, when you build a new solar project or you build a new battery to store it, and that's key, get to that in a second, or a new wind project or a new geothermal resource, if you don't have transmission lines available to access that and deliver it to customers, that generation is basically an island. It is stranded, he said. And of course, that is what a lot of the money in the bipartisan infrastructure bill and the Inflation Reduction Act that Joe Biden signed, both of them.
Yes.
Is going to yeah. increase transmission. Correct.
And it is happening faster and faster every year. But, you know, those kinds of things take time. So, yes, utility scale battery farms are coming online in the state of California. You know, every single week there's a new one, and transmission lines are a bit harder. But yeah, it actually is happening to close that gap.
Governor Gavin Newsom, his administration has also been pushing, in fact, to add more batteries, these great big batteries, to store that excess energy for use during peak demand time. So when we're collecting more energy than we can actually use, we don't have to shut it off, throw it all away. We can actually collect it in batteries and use it when we need it, whether it's at night, whether it's in the middle of a heat wave like much of the state is going through right now. But state regulators with the California Public Utilities Commission have taken a more controversial approach. Their answer is to drastically cut financial incentives for homeowners who are considering installing solar, which seems to me to be insane. They're actually making it harder now for homeowners to afford clean, free energy falling from the sky because we now apparently have too much of it in California. Am I understanding this story correctly, Des?
Yes, you are.
And this move has outraged many in the rooftop solar industry. According to the California Solar and Storage Association, residential solar installations have now dropped by 66% in the first quarter of 2024 compared with the same period back in 2022. The trade group estimates that since the state changed the incentive structure known as net metering, In fact, 17,000 green jobs have been lost statewide. How can that be? What are we doing? What is going on? We are killing ourselves to stop killing ourselves with fossil fuel. And here in California, we were doing a pretty good job, but now we're making it harder to do so. Desi Doyen, what is net metering, and how have the changes here actually made things worse than they should be?
Well, it helps to understand that, first of all, utilities make money by selling you energy. So the more energy you use, the more money that they profit from it. They don't profit when you use less energy, and they really don't profit when they have to pay you to generate electricity from your rooftop. So
because we generate the energy from the rooftop and sell it back to the grid.
Right. They don't make a profit off of that.
Yep.
So they don't like that. Ratepayers also fund utility investments in electric grid infrastructure. The utility will go to the Public Utility Commission to ask them to say, hey, we're going to really need to meet this extra energy. We're going to have to build a $1 billion natural gas plant that will fill in the gaps on big days. That's going to cost a lot of money. We got to raise the rates. The Public Utility Commission generally says, yes, okay, go ahead and do that. But when you have to pay rooftop solar homeowners, that means that they're not paying. Those homeowners are not paying for infrastructure. At least that's the argument that the utilities are making. So they're saying that means that non-solar customers who don't have rooftop solar, that means they've got to bear the cost of all this electric grid infrastructure.
So it costs me more. If my neighbor puts up solar, this argument goes. Somehow it costs me more if I don't have solar. It costs me more to buy energy.
The utility will charge you more as the non-solar person to fund any electric grid infrastructure or new power plants. So that is the argument. There are lots of studies, academic studies, that say that, okay, yeah, you know, it is kind of tricky and complicated in that way, but there's a big Brookings Institution study, for example, that shows that net metering is, in fact, a net benefit to the grid. That means that homeowners with rooftop solar actually help to prevent blackouts. They actually help to prevent the need to build expensive new power plants. But the utilities, again, don't like that because that's how they make their profit. So with the Public Utility Commission in California making this decision, it sounds like it is more of a benefit to the utility industry, and it's not exactly clear why Newsom approved it.
In a statement, Newsom has defended the state's policies. He says that already this year, the state has had nearly 100 days when clean energy has exceeded 100% of demand for at least some part of the day. Well, that doesn't sound like a boutique energy source to me. Quote, no other state in America comes close to California's solar production, said Newsom. We're generating nearly 20-fold the amount of solar as we were doing a decade ago, powering millions of homes with clean energy. And we're now adding more batteries faster than ever to help capture that energy to use at night. That's good, at least. But supporters of the state's change to the incentives also point to equity concerns, arguing that a shift to solar can raise the cost of energy for those who don't have it or can't afford it. I'm sorry, but I ain't buying it.
And the academic studies and all of the real-world studies are behind you.
Ed Murray, the president of the California Solar and Storage Association, disputes the argument of the governor. Given California's role as a leader in solar energy, Murray believes other states are watching all of this and may follow suit with the changes that are being made by the California Public Utilities Commission. He says, quote, I'm hearing from Florida, Arizona, Minnesota, Massachusetts. They're looking at copying the rules, that they're going to change the rules of the game. And folks are upset because it's going to hurt across the board. I mean, if solar installations are down 66% from 2 years ago, good Lord, we're doing such a good job. Why are we screwing it up?
Because the utility industry is a very powerful industry.
As California goes, he says, so usually does the rest of the country. It's an example that as California goes all in on its historic clean energy transition with the goal of achieving 100% clean energy by 2045, I think we'll do it well before then, to be frank. New challenges are casting a shadow on the path to a renewable future. Quote, no way we're going to get there without rooftop solar, said Murray. Electric vehicles, heat pumps, electric range tops. This is not going to happen without solar, period, he said. Anyway, in the wake of James Inhofe's death, even though some of this story is a bit maddening, I did think it was important to show how just how wrong he was in so many ways about things like renewable energy and how out here in California, the most populous state in the union, where we aren't a bunch of, you know, oil and coal industry paid stooges, we're now powering much of the state, sometimes 100% of it, via clean solar and wind capacity alone, to the point where we even have too much of it at times, which all in all, I think is a problem that I would much prefer to have to the one that James Inhofe had hoped to saddle the nation and the world with for the rest of humanity, which, if it was up to him, might not be very long. All of that to keep in mind this week, while the nation is facing a crippling heat wave from coast to coast, one made worse by climate change in the wake of a devastating, earlier-than-ever record hurricane, which has caused flooding and power outages and record tornadoes for millions of Americans to have to deal with, as discussed in our latest Green News report.
We have no way to keep our food cold.
Flooding, power outages, sweltering heat, hurricane barrel fallout still wreaking havoc across the U.S.
FEMA will now factor in the effects of future flooding for any federally funded construction project.
New flood risk standards will finally include climate impacts. Plus,
this bill is ridiculous. It is Congress at its worst.
And that is saying something. House Republicans tackle the real enemy, energy-saving appliances.
All of those enemies and more straight ahead from BradBlog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Is this the freedom and democracy that our country fought for? Arguing for kitchen appliances? Is this what your constituents are telling you? Because mine are telling me that they're terrified about the future of this country and about their families and their rights. And you're over here asking us to vote on a bill to protect the rights of dishwashers and refrigerators.
Well, with all due respect, Congresswoman Melanie Stansbury of New Mexico, the dishwashers and refrigerators are not going to protect themselves. This is your Green News Report.
Freedom of refrigerators and dignity for dishwashers. These are the real names of the bills that they're running this week. This ain't normal. This is insane.
Okay, Desi Doyen, the storm may be gone, but the pain lingers on.
Yes, sadly, the remnants of record-breaking Hurricane Beryl continue to wreak havoc as it moves across already waterlogged parts of the Midwest and Northeast U.S., underscoring how hurricane impacts extend far beyond coastal areas. As we go to air in the Houston region, officials say 10,000 line workers from around the country are working amid a sweltering heat wave to restore power to more than a million households still without electricity as heat indexes top 105 degrees. Mm. The lack of electricity and air conditioning, especially overnight, raises the risk of heat exhaustion and heat stroke. Scientists at Italy's ClimaWorks have concluded that man-made climate change caused by fossil fuel pollution supercharged Hurricane Beryl's record-breaking run, making the storm's wind and rain up to 30% more intense. In the U.S., Beryl has also produced one of the largest hurricane-induced tornado outbreaks in U.S. history, including rare tornadoes in Pennsylvania and New York. As an extended extreme heat wave bakes the U.S., Washington Post reports that the heat has killed at least 28 people across the nation in just the past week, a likely undercount, and the death toll is rising. The Phoenix region is on pace to surpass last year's record heat-related death toll, and the extreme temperatures in western states have even grounded emergency medical helicopters.
It was more than 100 degrees in Oregon.
And a new analysis by nonprofit Inside Climate News finds that long-lasting heat waves and increasingly intense severe floods are undermining transportation and distribution systems across the Midwest, damaging vital roads, bridges, and rail lines with increasingly costly consequences for commuters and the supply chain. In late June, the Biden administration announced another $2 billion in infrastructure grants across the U.S. to upgrade transportation systems for climate resilience.
Sure, but who's speaking up for the refrigerators?
President Joe Biden this week also unveiled new federal standards for flood risk management. In a significant shift, FEMA will now be allowed to incorporate the impacts of climate change when making funding decisions after disasters, to end the repetitive cycle of taxpayer funds going to rebuild the same vulnerable locations over and over.
And over again.
The new standards require all federal agencies to incorporate current and future flood risks for the structures the government funds, like schools, hospitals, police stations, and sewage treatment plants. President Obama originally ordered the revision, but it was revoked by President Trump, then reinstated by President Biden. However, the new standard is also now vulnerable to court challenge, thanks to recent rulings by the right-wing U.S. Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
But in the Republican-controlled U.S. House, the biggest issue is not Americans' health and safety during simultaneous deadly weather disasters, but blocking new Department of Energy efficiency standards for dishwashers and refrigerators.
Well, thank God.
The Republican House majority passed two new laws rolling back the new rules, even though they're supported by manufacturers and will save consumers on their energy bills. But the law will likely not pass in the Democratic-controlled U.S. Senate.
Well, that's good for now.
Yeah, Republicans really want you to spend as much as possible on energy.
I guess they do. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find, follow, and share us planet-wide on the Facebooks, Mastodons, and sites still known as Twitter at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
You're as cold as ice. You're willing to sacrifice our love.
Thank you very much, Desi Doyen. Thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program or any other we have ever done, you can download them anytime for free at bradblog.com. That is made possible by those of you kind enough to stop by bradblog.com/donate to help us stay on your public airwaves. Greatly appreciated. Drop me an email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Facebooks, Mastodons, and sites still known as Twitter, you will find me at the Brad Blog. You will find her, Desi Doyen,
at Green News Report.
We'll see you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
You're listening to The Bradcast. We are 100% listener-supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.